Stephen Bauer, First Minister. Thank you very much indeed. Very quick introductions, because I know we're keen to get into the meat of today's conversations as well. I'm really delighted to introduce Jonathan McClory, creator and author of the Soft Power 30 from Portland Communications, who's going to be sharing the results of the Wales Soft Power Barometer 2018. I hope you've all picked up as you came in the separate document. So, Jonathan, over to you.
Thank you very much. Gosh, I can't believe I have to follow that speech from the First Minister, but I will do my best. I'd like to start just with a couple of thank yous. First, a thank you to the Institute of Welsh Affairs for providing a platform for today's discussions. Second, just a huge and emphatic thank you to the British Council of Wales for making this research project possible. Before I found my way to Portland Communications and having an existence in the private sector, I was in the think tank world and worked for a couple of different think tanks in the UK, and the last one was the Institute for Government. And while I was there, I started work on trying to measure soft power, right, which is has been a big part of my professional life for the last decade, really, where every year I would go through the rather painful and tedious exercise of trying to arrive at metrics and rankings for the soft power of countries. And, great. In doing pretty much an annual report for the last 8 years on soft power, one of the central arguments that I tended to make, and I'll certainly come to it later in this talk, was that power is devolving. And right, being here in Wales, of course we know power is devolving. Devolution has been a huge part of what's happening in Welsh government and Welsh society since the late 90s, I suppose. But that power moving away from nation-state level governments to non-state actors is quite, a recent phenomenon and one that's quite important to what's going on in global affairs. And so governments that sit below the national level are part of this, right? Regions, cities, and please do forgive me for using the term region when describing Wales. I know that's probably a controversial thing to say, and I don't mean it in any kind of derogatory way. I know Wales, along with the other home countries, occupies a very unique place. But we use region as just, or subnational government, which is more in line with international relations terminology. So just, but please don't hold that against me. I'm not trying to do down Wales in any way. But as I was saying, so non-state actors becoming much more important in global affairs. And so I was always making this argument, and yet all of the research and that I've done, the reports that I've put out, have used the nation state as the unit of analysis. And so why I'm so grateful to British Council and British Council Wales, and in particular Christopher Lewis, who first contacted me last year about this project, was that this was an opportunity to finally explore that issue a bit more and try and look at soft power through the lens of a regional government or a subnational government, which I think is long overdue. And I think cities, you know, there are a number of different studies or indices on cities and influence, but there hasn't really been much around regions. So I was very excited to be able to undertake this research. So I think we have until about 11:45. It won't take me that long to go through the research. So I will talk you through the study, some of the findings and some of the insights that we drew out of the analysis on Wales, and then end with some recommendations for the Welsh government. After that, then we can do a quick Q&A until we hit 11:45, and then I'll hand back the podium. So Kieran has very helpfully set this up, right? So I don't need to spend too much time on this, but I always think it's helpful to start with definitions, right? And so just kind of stepping back and asking, what is soft power? Now, I think it's helpful to start with the overarching sort of IR-style definition of power, right? So power in international politics is the ability of one actor, which is usually a country, a nation state, to change the behavior of another actor and to get them to do something they would otherwise never have done. Now, traditionally, power has been thought of in realist terms in international relations, and that means hard power. So hard power is the exercise of influence through coercion, and it relies on tactics like military force or the threat of force, paying somebody to do something, or economic sanctions. right? It's about force. It's about pushing somebody to do something. Now, in contrast to that, soft power is about attraction and persuasion, using both of those to change the minds and change the behavior of someone else. And so soft power is generated and leveraged through things like cultural promotion, through public diplomacy, and really being seen to make a positive global contribution. You know, do people admire you through your conduct? Are you a good example, or are you a force for ill? So that's... There we go, a bit sticky. So Joseph Nye, again, as Sir Kieran mentioned, is the originator of soft power and coined the term in 1990 in an academic journal article. Now, this is something, it's not like soft power is brand new, right? It's not that he just materialized in 1990. This is something that goes back to Athens and Sparta, right? This is a long-standing phenomenon. It just didn't have a name, and it didn't have a conceptual framework behind it. But that's what Joseph Nye did. He gave it a name and explained the phenomenon in a very helpful and clear way. And so Nye, who originated the concept, points to three primary sources of soft power. So the first is political values, right? And these tend to be understood as things like democracy, human rights, free speech, free press, and other sort of elements of of individual liberty. The second pillar is culture, and this can be understood both as high culture, so it can be, you know, Chinese opera, the Bolshoi Ballet, the Victoria and Albert Museum, but it's also pop culture, right? And it's also sports as well. It's Gareth Bale, it's Harry Potter, it's Korean soap operas and Japanese pop music. It's both that high and not low, but popular culture. And then the third pillar is foreign policy, and this, again, goes back to what I was saying about being seen to be making a positive global contribution. You know, are you a force for good in the world, or are you seen as a force for ill? So if we take a step back and hopefully understanding our definition of soft power now, the Soft Power 30, which is a nation state level study that we've run for the past 3 years at Portland, in the most recent report, and certainly we highlighted as well in the soft power, regional soft power barometer, the report that you were given today, there are three global megatrends that are really driving change in international politics. And it's important that we pay attention to these trends because this is the context in which the Welsh government has to operate on the global stage. So the first is geopolitical volatility. This kind of started in 2016 as very much a transatlantic thing with the Brexit votes and then shortly thereafter the victory of President Donald Trump and the ushering in of an America First doctrine. Now, I'm not here to make any kind of value judgment about those electoral outcomes, but what I will say is that they have led to a great deal of uncertainty in both economic and geopolitical terms. Now, Brexit is much more localized, obviously, to the UK and its relationship with the European Union. Obviously, there are other considerations that some countries outside of the European have voiced, not least Japan and Japanese manufacturers. But the America First, that doctrine has much wider implications. And it's happening at a time, particularly in the Pacific, where you see sort of a retreat away from free trade and the US withdrawing from TPP. At the same time, you see a rising China, and all of a sudden China has become, you know, a key defender of international trade and even a main proponent of environmentalism, which would seem unthinkable if we think back just 3 years ago. But this is where we are, right? So a great deal of geopolitical volatility. And that has an impact on Wales' standing and foreign policy in the world. So the second trend is devolving power, which I hinted at earlier. Now, power is shifting from west to east. So the economic and political center of gravity around the world is, you know, moving away from the Atlantic more towards the Pacific. But also, as I said, power is shifting away from national-level governments altogether. So multinational corporations, NGOs, multilateral bodies, regional governments, you know, subnational governments, cities are all playing a larger role. And they want in, they want to have a say on key global affairs. So the third trend then is the digital revolution. And these arguments are very well rehearsed. I won't really dwell on it, but What it means is that people are demanding instant information. They want accessible governments to explain their policies, explain what's going on. People demand transparency. There's new means for communicating with international audiences. So digital diplomacy has to be part of the toolkit of ministries of foreign affairs. And finally, there's just a proliferation of platforms for activism and publishing and kind of a deluge of information and opinion. As I said, I've been doing this kind of studying of soft power and public diplomacy for a decade, and you know, probably 5-6 years ago, I would say this also means the death of propaganda. But obviously, we've been very, very wrong about that. Happy to hold my hand up and say I was mistaken. And now we have kind of competing facts and competing narratives, which we have to be aware of as well. So. What does all this mean, and why does it involve soft power, and why should we care? Well, taken together, these three global trends make for a much more complex global stage, and we've arrived at a place where getting anything done by yourself in international affairs is incredibly difficult. And the way change happens now is through networks. And so governments, be they national or subnational, need to work with other partners to bring together networks of actors to get things done. And soft power is ultimately the fuel that drives that. It's what allows, Wales, for example, to bring together a network of actors and try and marshal them towards some eventual outcome or objective. So that's essentially why soft power matters. Now, taking a step back and dealing a bit more with this idea of, you know, regional governments, subnational governments. As we say in the report launched today, there are three factors that make this possible and necessary. So just the fact that regions and cities are engaging on global issues in ever greater numbers with more purpose and certainly more urgency. So the first thing that's making this possible and necessary is globalization, right? Economic interdependence, constant competition for mobile capital and mobile talent, and also transnational challenges and issues, right? These are something, I think it was Fareed Zakaria has said, problems without passports, right? So globalization means that cities and regions have to have a say. They have to think beyond their borders on key issues. The second is autonomy and devolution, right? So as I've said, Wales has been a poster child for devolution and taking on ever greater autonomy and authority. And part of that is, you know, happening writ large around the globe as power moves away from national level governments towards non-state actors. And then there's the rise of, it's written up there as non-traditional diplomacy, but parallel diplomacy. I don't know if that's a term anyone's come across, but parallel diplomacy is the concept of city governments or regional governments engaging in public diplomacy. So rather than going via their ministries of foreign affairs or the FCO in Wales' case, it's having those Welsh offices abroad that can engage directly with international audiences, or it's the first minister going to China and engaging directly with the Chinese rather than going via the national level government. So parallel diplomacy is that term, and there are simply more platforms to engage the global public, whether that's, you know, through analog content or events, or whether it's through digital means. And then the final factor that really makes this possible is that increasingly national level governments are okay with this. They're quite happy to have, you know, their regions or cities get out there and fly the flag. National level governments recognize that diffusion of power. They know that the subnational governments have a role to play. They also can see that benefits accrue to the nation as a whole. So if Wales goes out there and wins new investment and brings more international students into Wales, that's good for Britain. That's good for the United Kingdom. And then I think the example of Wales and Argentina was brought up, and I think this is really important. This is a very important point. Subnational governments can engage international publics in a way that minimizes or even completely drops political baggage, right? Wales doesn't have political baggage with Argentina when it comes to the Falklands War, and so it's much easier to engage. Same would be true, I think, of many American states or cities, where they can engage with international publics without some of that America First rhetoric, or when it was, you know, 15 years ago, without some of the Iraq War baggage, right? And it's easier because they're closer to people-to-people levels. So, measuring soft power, right? If we're going to use soft power, and it's important to say as well that as Wales does not have an army, it does not, obviously there's the Welsh Guards and everything, but not, they don't operate on their own, as I understand it. But also Wales doesn't have the ability to, you know, slap economic sanctions by itself on someone else. The sources of influence for subnational governments exist almost entirely in the soft power sphere, right? So that's all they've got to work with. So they really need to know what they have to work with. What are those soft power assets? So this is Joseph Nye's model for the conversion of soft power, right? So using soft power effectively starts with understanding what resources a country has at its disposal. And it's really only with a clear understanding of what soft power a country has, or a regional government, can it be deployed effectively? So these are the steps, right? It starts with resources, and then eventually moves to, you know, what are our objectives? What are we trying to achieve? Eventually some means of conversion, and then a target response, and eventually an outcome. But like I said, it starts with resources. We have to know what we've got to work with if we're going to deploy it successfully. So that's essentially, that first step of resources, understanding what we've got to work with, that's essentially what we set out to try and address with this report. Now, the Soft Power 30, as I said, is an annual study that we do that looks at, you know, the nation state level, and we look at the soft power resources of countries. And what we did with this, and really, I suppose, the brief as it came from British Council Wales, was to try and take that basic framework and make it work, you know, reconstitute it, adapt it for regional governments, and that's essentially what we sought to do. I guess the important thing to say is that the Regional Soft Power Index, you know, it benefits from years and years of studying and building these different composite indices, albeit those indices were focused on nation states. But that's what we tried to do. So we. The thing that really, I suppose, makes the Soft Power 30, that framework, particularly unique, and I would argue, I guess, as the author, useful, I'm a bit biased, is that it combines objective data with subjective data, with international polling. So we started from that same principle, right? So this is the objective data side of the framework. So we start with Joseph Nye's sources of soft power, right? That's the initial inspiration and sort of the cornerstone of building the composite index, building the metrics. And so for political values, that becomes government in our model. For culture, it just remains culture, quite simply. That foreign policy pillar then becomes engagement, which is meant to be, you know, global engagement, international engagement. But based on long-running academic literature review, which we update every year, you know, we identified other areas that have an impact on perceptions of a country or a region. And so we have some additional categories of metrics, right? So the first is enterprise, which isn't about the total size of a country or a region's economy. It's about the attractiveness of that region or country's economic and business model, right? Its capacity for innovation. And then we also add education, metrics on education, and this is really focused on higher education, which I'm glad was mentioned, I think, several times already this morning. So we look at international students, we look at quality of universities, we look at academic publishing, among other metrics. And then the final component is a digital category. And the digital category has two parts to it. The first is just looking at overall digital infrastructure. You know, how well connected is a country? How accessible is high-speed broadband? What value do citizens get from from access to the internet in that region or country. Then the second part is looking at basically digital diplomacy. What are the platforms that a government has to engage with international audiences through social media, which is increasingly important. So that covers off the objective data. Now, I won't talk you through every single metric, but in the report that hopefully you've picked up, there is an annex with all of the metrics, which you can look through if you're really bored in your chairs later. So as I said, the other part of the framework that we used is international polling. So what we try to do is look at what are the most common touch points through which somebody in another country is likely to experience another place, an international place. And so the areas we look at are cuisine, sport, perceived friendliness of a population, culture, luxury goods, political values, and perceived livability. Is this a place you'd want to go live, work, or study? So for the polling, for that subjective data, we polled 5,000 people across 10 different countries to collect that subjective data. So we polled people in Canada, the US, Ireland, France, Germany, Qatar, UAE, India, China, and Japan. Now, polling is one of those things where it'd always be great to have more, but it is very expensive to do. So we think we did a pretty good job looking at some of the countries that are, important for Wales, and also give us a decent sweep of North America, Europe, and Asia, as well as the Middle East, or at least the Gulf. So then in summary, this is the combined framework that gives us the composite index that we use to eventually put all the data together, crunch the numbers, which then produces a single score for each region, and then that's how we derive our rankings. So we put more emphasis on the objective data. So 70% of the overall score for each region is based on the objective data, right? We prioritize the things that we can touch and feel, and maybe even some of the levers that we can pull in government. And then the remaining 30% is calculated through the subjective data. Now, the one thing I should say as well, we don't include it in the actual scores or the calculation of the scores, but we also do a question on overall favorability, just without any prompt, how favorable 1 to 10 do you feel about region X? And we use that overall favorability to run a regression analysis against the 7 different categories of polling. And what this does is this allows us to give weighting to the different categories. So we understand what are the drivers of favorability, what are the things that really have the largest impact on shaping perceptions of a region. And what we found on that was that actually, I believe it's livability, is the highest or has the largest impact, but that weighting as well is in the report. So who did we look at, right? Obviously, we were commissioned by British Council Wales, and I'm standing here in front of you in Cardiff, so obviously we looked at Wales. But then who else did we look at? Well, we chose 9 different regions to compare with Wales. I suppose, like the polling, it would have been great to perhaps have a few more, but we sort of saw this as an initial study, and it's still, as I'll come to with some of the challenges that exist when moving from nation state level of analysis to subnational governments, it can be really hard to find data on regions and make sure that data is comparable. But what we did was we started with Wales, and then we looked at 9 other regions that are broadly comparable. I mean, certainly not perfectly comparable, but not outrageously different in terms of GDP size, level of devolved authority, population size, overall level of development. And then finally, we wanted to look at regions that have a history of international engagement. And so we looked at Quebec in Canada, we looked at Puerto Rico in the US, we also looked at Scotland and Northern Ireland. We looked at Flanders in Belgium, Catalonia in Spain, Corsica in France, Jeju Island in South Korea, and Hokkaido in Japan. So, yes, as I said, trying to move from the nation state to subnational governments is not without its challenges. The 4 biggest ones that we faced were, the first is definition. What constitutes a regional government? And I'm sure we could debate that just on Wales. We could probably spend a lot of time on that. The second is comparability. So not all regions are perfectly comparable in the way that nation states are, that countries are. Can you compare California to Hunan province in China? You know, do they both have the same level of autonomy and all sorts of things? But that becomes rather difficult to work out. The third is data availability. So different regions follow different standards and practices for data collection, and there aren't as many reliable secondary sources of data where there are with countries. You know, you can go to the IMF or the World Bank or UNESCO or OECD, whereas that doesn't really exist for regions. That's one thing I would love for Wales to do, actually, thinking about it. We should add that as a recommendation. Start leading the charge on data standards for regional governments. That would be a huge help to researchers everywhere. And then finally, awareness, right? So there are varying levels of awareness when it comes to regions, and they start at a disadvantage compared to nation states. Right, so on to the results, which I'm sort of glad the First Minister has left, because with all that Scotland talk, this would have been awkward. But he's going to find out eventually. So Quebec, congratulations to Quebec, coming the top of the rankings, followed by Scotland, Flanders, Catalonia, Hokkaido, then Wales, Corsica, Northern Ireland, Jeju, and Puerto Rico. So just to take you through some of the results. So one of the things that makes this framework quite useful is that we can break down the performance of regions by the different component parts. So we can look at the strengths and weaknesses of each region based on those categories, and obviously based on the polling. And so just looking very quickly at some of the top countries, or regions rather. So Quebec was strongest in government, education, and enterprise. So I believe Quebec led the table in number of international students, actually. So moving on to Scotland. So Scotland was strongest in education, enterprise, and digital. And we won't dwell on Scotland. And then Flanders, which was a bit of a surprise third place finish. I had thought Catalonia would take second or third in sort of idle speculation while we were waiting for data to come in. But Flanders had a really good showing, particularly in the objective data, and did strongest on government, culture, and engagement. There are a lot of... the Flanders government international offices around the world. They are incredibly well connected. They have a ton of sister city arrangements as well. So on to why we're here. Wales. How did Wales perform? So sixth place is, I think, an all right finish. I think what we found overall is that Wales starts from a decent base. There's clearly room for improvement, but there are definitely strengths that we can think about leveraging now, and maybe other things to address. So the first thing to say is that Wales is strongest in the digital category. And I think this is overall digital infrastructure, but actually the Welsh government is doing pretty well on social media in terms of what we found. So that's definitely encouraging. Enterprise is also a strength for Wales, which I think the First Minister certainly hammered home convincingly during his speech. Now, one of the things that we found is there's plenty to celebrate on enterprise for Wales. But R&D was particularly low. So if we were going to look at something around enterprise that Wales could do better, more R&D spending would certainly help. So in terms of areas to address, so Wales performs less well on education, and this is a reflection of fewer international students than other regions. Now, I understand there's a program, there's Global Wales, I think, is a program underway to try and lead the charge and fly the Welsh flag for more international students, so that's definitely a good thing. And we know that, you know, Wales has some excellent universities, so we think it's more just trying to leverage what we already have in terms of higher education and making sure that more international students or would-be international students could consider Wales. We also saw kind of middling performances on government, culture, and engagement. And these are assets to build on, but clear room for improvement. I think as well, I believe some more devolution changes have come in recently, and there might be a bit of a lag effect. So that could be improving if we were to continue to look at this going forward in subsequent years. So on the international polling, the international polling was a bit more disappointing, I guess, in the objective data, and we can get into that a little bit. On the positive side, and this was something that we sort of debated about: should we include something on sport? Which in the end we did, which was good for Wales because that was where Wales did best, right? Wales came second overall in terms of polling on sport. And then Wales gets mid-table position for perceptions around political values. And then I think just the most puzzling thing was the perceptions around friendliness. So anybody who isn't Welsh who's visited Wales has probably had, I certainly hold my hand up as a regular visitor to Tenby. My experiences with the Welsh people have been nothing but pleasant, and much more pleasant than people in England, frankly. But that hasn't cut through to at least the countries that we polled. And I don't know, it's perhaps just lack of experience with Welsh people or what it might be, but that was something that sort of left us scratching our head a bit. In terms of Wales' rank on cuisine, no comment. Yes, anyway, so there are things to build on, but... and maybe one of the issues around polling. Now, this doesn't factor into any of the scoring. But one of the things that we did when we did the polling is we just wanted to understand what do people associate with different regions. And so we asked a question with no prompt at all, just a blank entry. You know, what do you most associate with this region? And this. Not exactly perfectly scientific word cloud, at least gives you an idea of the things that came up. So rugby winning out, obviously, which speaks to why Wales did well in the polling around sport. But then the things that show up, they don't really kind of... There's not enough differentiation, we felt, between Wales and the rest of the UK. And there's also an association with the royal family. And I don't know if that's a Prince of Wales sort of thing, that sort of sticks in people's head. I'm not 100% sure. But the associations were really fragmented. And what we saw in some of the top three countries is that there were real clusters around what people associated with Quebec and certainly Scotland that were very different from the rest of the UK. And Wales was kind of lacking that. And so we think, you know, maybe that opinions on Wales kind of remain largely unformed, which is not great, but at the same time, maybe it means that opinions can be more malleable around Wales, and it's just about raising overall profile, and those associations might change. So as I said, this doesn't directly impact the study or the rankings, but it was just something that gives the polling a bit more context. So some overall thoughts to leave you with that came out of the overall report. So overall awareness is a challenge for regions, right? Regions on the whole are at a disadvantage vis-a-vis nation states, and they have to work all the more hard to build their global profile. So the second big conclusion is that history of non-state nation building really helps. So if you look at, you know, Scotland has a long-running independence movement, Catalonia as well, Quebec as well, and not making any electoral value judgments on any of that, but there's a history of trying to engage in non-state nation building. And I think that using things like, or trying to build more of a national identity through political, civic, cultural, linguistic means kind of gives them more of a profile globally in the minds of international public opinion. So then the third point is that greater autonomy, for the most part, equals more soft power. And higher levels of regional government authority, which was a metric that went into the index, seem to correlate with greater soft power reserves overall. So, fourth, Wales is starting from a decent base, but there's plenty of room for improvement. We think focus should be on educational elements of soft power and on being seen as friendly and welcoming. And then that final point around differentiation, which I mentioned, differentiation from the rest of the UK, I think will be very important. And there's a lot of work to do around that. So some final recommendations and food for thought for the Welsh government. So the first thing, I think this will be easy. It's just about exposing people, you know, international audiences to Welsh people. But we need to address this friendliness issue. As I said, this was a bit of a head scratcher for us when we got the data back. But we think a renewed tourism campaign that rather than concentrating too much on, you know, landscapes and castles and things like that, which are lovely and beautiful, it should focus on people and should focus on, you know, perhaps people working in the hospitality industry or the cultural industry, but we need to tell a story about Welsh people. And that, I think, will then have an impact on this, you know, this friendliness issue that came out of the polling. The second recommendation is to build on this global Wales partnerships with universities, right? More international students is great, it's good for the economy, and it's good for Welsh soft power in the long run. So the more we can do to bring in more international students, the better. The third is that I really recommend that Wales should invest in a large-scale, on-the-ground public diplomacy campaign at the 2019 Rugby World Cup in Japan. You know, sport is clearly what people think about with Wales, and they think about it in a good way, so let's build on that. And we're also thinking about, you know, what does the future of Wales hold outside of the European Union? You know, what does a post-Brexit Wales look like? It's happening in Japan. You've got a ready-made Asian audience. So I think to go big on that would be very important. So start building a Wales house. Start planning to have a Wales house in Tokyo now. The fourth recommendation is to overhaul the Welsh government's management structure for international affairs with a dedicated directorate that manages all international facing issues and create a ministerial portfolio in cabinet to look after all international affairs for Wales. Because right now, and others will know this much better than I will, but as I understand it, looking at the organigrams and things, there are different aspects in different directorates, and there just isn't any kind of, you know, central coordination around that. And we think that that would really focus minds and probably allow the government to be more strategic with resources when trying to build and leverage Welsh soft power. So finally, as we've heard a little bit of it today, we should leverage the Welsh language as a key differentiator for Wales. They definitely don't speak Welsh in England or the rest of the UK. And also, I think, globally, Wales could do more to champion bilingualism and really kind of lead the charge on saving endangered or unique languages. I think that would be a real differentiating factor for Wales that would help raise profile. So that is it with those recommendations. I think I rambled on longer than I thought I would. We have a few minutes for questions, which I'm happy to take if anybody have any. Yes? Oh, yeah, sorry.
Hello, yes. Nick van der Valera, Flanders.
Ah!
Just one remark that my region is a very strange one in this, that it also has very hard power.
Yeah.
We have treaty-making power, which all the others do not have. Referring to CETA and our colleagues of Wallonia, which our Canadian friends well know, that we can block European treaties as well, and that's very hard power.
Yes, yes, yes.
Hello, Amanda Wilkinson, University of Wales. I'm going to ask a question I've asked before, and I might sound like a broken record, but I'm interested in gender issues in relation both to the responses you've had, but also in terms of the recommendations. So we score very highly on sport. I suspect those are male sports. So in terms of your recommendation 3, are we in danger of just getting men talking to men, and is that really the future for soft power in Wales?
Well, sport on the polling was really open to interpretation. So there certainly wasn't any, the question wasn't to what extent do you admire men's only sports in that region. So I don't know. I take your point that you'd want to guard against that and make sure that there was gender equality in the discussion around sports. We didn't focus purely on men only sports. If that answers the question.
I have to say I'm quite surprised about the issue that's come out of the report in terms of the friendliness of the people in Wales, because one of the things we pride our nation on is the friendliest and warm welcome that we give people.
Yeah.
I wonder what the time frame of the report, the research period was, and whether the vote in Wales in relation to Brexit had an impact.
Yeah, it's possible, but I would just be speculating. So we put the polling into the field in February of this year. So the polling data is pretty fresh. So it's not like Brexit would have, it was, you know, immediately after that. I mean, what I would say is, referring back to the Soft Power 30 study, the difference in the polling data on the UK, and there's fairly similar polling data structure. The UK, for polling that was done in EU member states, they definitely felt less positive about the UK than they had in 2016, comparing 2016 and 2017, right? So there was an impact. The rest of the world, though, kind of collectively shrugged, and there wasn't much of a perceptible change. But it is possible, as we did poll in Ireland, France, and Germany, that could have had an impact. But because we didn't ask that question directly, that's more speculation than anything else. But that, like I said, that did puzzle us because, it cuts against my experience anyway of Wales. Yes?
Sorry. Hi. You made a brief mention of R&D and the fact that there's a low score around research and development. Could you say more about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, we looked at data on R&D spending for all the regions, and Wales didn't do very well on that, comparatively. I'm not saying that none happens, but compared to the other regions, it wasn't as high, wasn't as good.
Hi, Tracy McNulty from Swansea Council. I'm kind of reflecting on the previous last but one question. With the response to perception, the kind of word cloud, it was very much English, Anglo-centric.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of puzzled as to whether the other responses were responding to perceptions of England and the UK as opposed to perceptions of Wales. So how the integrity of the perception of things like friendliness or connectivity and all of those things, how can you disaggregate or begin to really get to the granular of understanding they were responses to Wales when the word cloud seemed to indicate it was a response to England?
Yeah, so, well, that I think that's the challenge. You rightly identify. I mean, with the question was asked of Wales, and there was no mention of the UK or Great Britain at all. But you're absolutely right, and that was what jumped out at us, was that there's no real differentiation between things that are uniquely Wales or Welsh and the rest of the UK. So I think that's the challenge for Wales.
Hi, thank you. Rhina Piorwerth, Assembly Member, Chair of the Cross-Party Group Wales International. What attempt have you made to measure both the size and the impact engagement of the Welsh diaspora and the diasporas of those other sub-state regions?
Short answer is not enough. So there wasn't anything on diaspora. There wouldn't have been, it'd be nice to have, there wouldn't have been that data across all the different regions. It just wouldn't be possible. But definitely worth considering in terms of, you know, how the Welsh government goes about engagement. So I think it's important. We just couldn't measure it.
Helo, Elined Haf o Celfyddydau Rhyngwladol Cymru, a dwi am siarad yng Nghymraeg. If you'd like to have your headset, diolch. Just isio croesawu'r adroddiad ma'n y lle cyntaf, deud mor ddiddorol ydy o, yn arbennig bod gennym ni gyd-destun rhyngwladol i beth sy'n mynd ymlaen a cael gogwydd o'r tu allan i fewn, sydd ddim bob amser yn rhywbeth cyfforddus yn ei gael. Ond dwi'n hynod ddiolchgar i'r British Council ac i'r IWA am wneud hynny. Ond dwi hefyd hoffwn i weld fwy yn datblygu'n o ran lle mae gwlad fel Cymru, a dwi'n meddwl bod ti'n iawn i ni alw'n hynna'n ymwlad, hyd yn oed os da ni ddim yn wladwriaeth fel sy'n cael ei gydnabod ar lefel Brydeinig. So hoffwn i glywed yr term gwlad yn dod i fewn yn hytrach na just rhanbarth. Ond hefyd yn fwy'r dyfodol, sut ydy ni oes na ymchwil wedi wneud neu allu'd cael ei wneud i fewn i pan fo'r gwlad o dan wladwriaeth ehangach, efo falle gwerthoedd sydd yn amrywio, sydd angen dod allan fwy a sut allwn ni fesur hynny. A yng nghyd-destun beth sy'n digwydd efo Brexit a pan mae gennych chi ymgyrchion Brydeinig mawr ymdymlaen yn rhyngwladol, a be fysa'r ôl cyrff llywodraeth ar lefel Cymreig, neu Albaneg, a wedyn ar lefel Prydeinig, a sut mae rhywun yn gallu mynd a cydweithio ar ddwy lefel yn effeithiol.
So I didn't catch all of that. I don't think that's a question that I can answer. I think that's one for the Welsh government, Welsh people. I think more research on it would be helpful. But I think there's probably a bit of soul searching to be done about, in this context, what are Welsh values and how do we then try and communicate those? And what platforms do we have to do that exist outside of the British structure? I hope that's an adequate answer.
Did you get any sense from the data about the extent to which Wales' soft power is experienced through its cities, or was it largely experienced through the nation state or the country?
So, sort of. On the objective data, in the engagement category, one of the things that we looked at were sister city arrangements, because we think that's quite important, right? We were trying to look at people-to-people exchanges, and Wales did okay on that. I think more could be done. If memory serves, I think Flanders did very well on that. The short answer is the focus was on regions rather than cities, but there was an element of that. We did also look at quality of the largest airport in each region. So Cardiff Airport was the one that we looked at. If that.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much. Thank you.